Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
You go into your shower feeling tired, but as soon as you reach for the Irish Spring, your day immediately gets better. That crisp, fresh, unmistakable Irish Spring scent zings your brain and awakens your senses. So when you finally emerge from the shower, 37 minutes later, because you pay the water bill so you can stay in there as long as you want, you're ready to take on the day and smell great doing it. Irish Spring Body Wash and Bar Soap. Fresh, green, Irish. Shop now at a store near you.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful. Listen to A Really Good Cry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Blitz. Homer picked it up briefly and Smith flipped. Wide open caught. Disley, touchdown. What a start. Wilson floats it. There's Judy. Pass caught. Judy still going. Down inside the 20. And touchdown Denver Broncos from 64. McManus. Missed it. A lot of people were wondering if Geno Smith could hold his own here against his Hall of Fame predecessor coming back to town, and I'd say he did that and more. Yeah, I would agree with that.
A lot of people were wondering, that's right, Joe Buck, but I wasn't, and neither was my guest tonight, Stephen Ruiz, my co-president, I would say, in Geno Nation over the years. It happened. The Seattle Seahawks won 17-16 on Monday Night Football in the return of Russell Wilson. There is so much to get to in this game, but Stephen, for people that don't know, a writer at The Ringer does great stuff. We can get into all that later, but most importantly, has always believed, like me, not just as a bit, but in his heart, that Geno Smith was better than people gave him credit for. It now is here. He just won this actual game. It's an actual thing that happened in the year 2022. I don't care if they go 1-16. They can never take this night away from us. How are you feeling?
Never. It was a long time coming, man. It was a long time coming. There's been a lot of starts and stops to the Geno Nation agenda, but we're rolling, baby.
2022. Did you ever think this day would come? Because I kept thinking during the game, and we will go through it all and really give a real breakdown, and there's obviously more to talk about than other than Geno Smith, but his performance, which was fantastic, is certainly a big story. There were moments throughout the game where I was just like, I kind of can't believe this, because I didn't think he'd ever really get a chance as a week one starter, much less as a week one starter on the team that he just, you know, understudied for Russell Wilson in this moment, and that the crowd would be chanting Geno, Geno, like throughout the game, early, often, and then to finish it, like I don't know.
Storybook stuff.
I was going to say I'm speechless, but all I am doing is honking too much. Let's get into the game of it all, Stephen. I think let's start at the end and move our way backwards. Because as amazing as Geno was in the first half of this game, in the Seahawks only had 3 possessions in the second half, the story at the end of the game was obviously that last possession with Russell Wilson and Nathaniel Hackett. And I do kind of want to go over that first, because that was the most bizarre 4-minute drive to end a game that I can remember, with Nathaniel Hackett and Russell Wilson both simultaneously sort of freezing up and them ending up going for that long mid 60-yard field goal for Brandon McManus.
Just casually just asking your kicker to break an NFL record, the second longest kick in NFL history, just casually. You had plenty of time. But like, I felt like we spent so much time during the offseason discussing whether like Russell Wilson will work in this offense and how he left Seattle. And I feel like Nathaniel Hackett being a first year coach and a guy that's kind of, it feels like he's out of his depth already. And he hasn't had like a great, he hasn't had multiple years like as a good offensive coordinator. He had the years with Green Bay, but that was obviously Matt LaFleur was calling the plays. This was as rough as a first game as you can come up with. It was not even just the field goal. Going back the drive before that, the fourth down, I think it was from the 9-yard line. You have Russell Wilson, you're paying him $250 million. You got to go for it there. The field goal just cuts the, you had a one possession, cut it to another one possession, and then you end up with a 64-yard field goal. Just a horror show for Nathaniel Hackett.
Yeah, so I'm like the worst podcast host here. This is why we have Dan Hansis usually do it. He sets up the game. He puts it all in order. He would probably let the guests speak a little more than like 10 seconds in the first 3 minutes of the show. But I'm just sort of losing my mind. But to set the table, Russell Wilson and the Broncos were down, as you mentioned, 17-13 heading into the fourth quarter. There had been no scoring in the third quarter at all. The Broncos had moved the ball incredibly well, I would say, throughout the night. They ended up with 433 yards, which is a lot when you only had seven real possessions or eight real possessions in that game. So they were moving the ball well. They're winning physically. And in the fourth quarter, it felt like they were getting anything they want, but they kept getting stopped inside the 10-yard line. And you mentioned one of them, not where they lost the fumble, but where they end up kicking that field goal. They get a quick three and out from Geno. It was the first three and out of the game by either side. And then they get the ball back with 4 minutes and 2 seconds left in all three timeouts. And the thought there is, in a perfect world, we have all the time in the world. We are kind of getting what we want. For the most part, we have crazy mismatches on the outside. Our running game, for the most part, has been great. And Russell Wilson's effective getting the ball out quickly, kind of in the flats to his tight ends. And he should be able to move the ball down the field slowly, try to burn all the clock, and go win the ball game on a field goal. They've gotten into field goal range literally every possession that they had the whole game. Let's do that. And that was apparently what they were trying to do early in the drive. They weren't taking any rush with the ball. They're letting the play clock go down. Seattle actually ends up using a timeout, trying to challenge a call that didn't work. It ends up being a first down for Denver, and they're taking their time. And I'm actually thinking, this is really smart. At some point, like, when did you realize that they actually had no idea what they were doing? They were wasting their time, and they wouldn't even use those timeouts in the end.
It was that last snap, like, and their right. pre-snap operation was bad all game. Like, it felt like Russell Wilson was fighting the play clock all game long. And I thought Russ was going to call height there. And all of a sudden he calls timeout, and then the kicking unit comes on. And then the funny thing is Nathaniel Hackett starts to use his timeouts after the Seahawks get the ball back with like 6 seconds left. Then he uses the timeouts to stop the kneeling at 6 seconds. I'm astounded. I'm astounded. You would think, like, when you become a head coach, that's the first thing you kind of study and you lock down. And then just to have that happen in the first game. I mean, I'm not going to write him off after one game, but it's got to be hard to have confidence in him going forward, at least for this season.
Right. I put a little bit of it on Russell Wilson. I guess it should be on the coach. But like, if Tom Brady is running that team, like, there's no way any of that happens. Like, couldn't he have overridden what was going on at some point to play like a little faster? So they get their last first down of the game with coming out of the 2 minute warning. It was that 9-yard pass to Javonte Williams. He does not go out of bounds. And again, I think, like, okay, that's bad situational football by Broncos. He should go out of bounds. Then again, like, they actually shouldn't mind milking the clock a little bit. There's still right. 2 minutes. I can almost hear Tony Romo in my head. Hey, you have plenty of time. You got all three timeouts. Don't be in a hurry. That said, they don't take the next step till 1:24 left on the clock. That snap goes totally bonkers. Cody Barton makes a great play in the backfield. Again, it seemed to be some sort of snap operation where it was confusing at the last second. There was a problem for Russell Wilson all night. Barton gets injured on the play, so it ends up being a Seahawks timeout. And after that, there's incompletion, a short pass, an incompletion, a short pass again to Javonte Williams, who breaks a tackle, and that was it. That was the end of the game. Then they kicked the field goal. At that point, it was 4th and 5. Do you think there was any thought of, like, we don't totally trust where our offense is right now out of Russell Wilson to get those 5 yards, and we'd rather have Brandon McManus kick it. I don't know.
There's no reason to think that, though. Like you said, they were moving the ball, and especially the last couple drives, it seemed like Seattle had backed off. They were playing a lot of like soft zone coverage, and if you just wanted to dump a pass off to Javonte Williams for like 5 yards, they could have had it, and they had the timeouts to stop the clock. It was just a bizarre decision.
Right, because when Javonte Williams got tackled there was more than 50 seconds left in the game, and they had all three timeouts. Like, what would even be the, I guess, if they don't pick up the first down, but you're losing. At that point, you're under a minute left, and you're losing the game. It makes no sense whatsoever, obviously.
Yeah, it's not good. And I know we've said that the offense was really moving the ball, but that I think like the things we feared about what this offense would become with Russ is that like every offense in Seattle became the Russ offense, where you're just living out of structure and you're throwing it deep. And I think we saw that. And although they put up points and or they moved the ball, at least they didn't score, they didn't finish off drives, it never felt like they got in a rhythm as an offense until the fourth quarter when they started going up tempo and they started going hurry up. Before that, I felt like there was a lack of synergy between their under center stuff, which I think they really leaned on early, and their shotgun stuff.
Right.
And for this offense to work, it's the Shanahan McVay type of offense where everything is kind of interconnected and you need to set up the play action passes with the run game. And the run game was working. The deep passing game was working when Russ was in the gun and kind of doing stuff out of structure. But the play action passing from under center, Russ's A dot tonight was 3.2 yards. Ooh. It was all flats. It was like all throws to the flat off play action, a lot of boots. They didn't have that mid-range game, and that's always what drives this type of offense. Like, you think about like even the Jared Goff days in Los Angeles, it was always those deep overs. Jimmy G in San Francisco, the same thing. Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay, but we didn't get that with Russ. So, you know, you look at the stats, you see that Russ was average almost like 10 yards per attempt.
He ends up with 340 yards. Judy goes over 100 and Sutton goes over 72. But you don't think it really was a good feel. I'm with you.
No, it's I think it's going to be hard to sustain. There was no completions over the middle, like over 10 yards, 10 to 20 yards. And that's like an area of the field you really have to attack in this offense in particular. And they just were unable to do it. And you have to go back and watch the film. But I'm pretty sure Aikman said that Jerry Judy was running wide open over the middle on the play. I think it was the last play before the field goal when he checked it down to
Jerry
Javonte
Judy,
Williams.
They said was running wide open over the middle. That's where Russell kind of misses throws. He kind of motioned like, how come the ball didn't come my way? He ends up going to Javonte Williams, who does break a tackle. It could have been like 4th and 10,
right.
And it actually would have saved Nathaniel Hackett from this nightmare, because I doubt he would have lined up McManus for a 68-yarder or a 70-yarder. They probably would have just gone for the 4th and 10, but Russell didn't see that. And that's why I don't want to be like too critical on Russell Wilson when, like I said, they only had 8 possessions. They moved the ball that well. But people smarter than me are watching this game. Sean King, my favorite Tulane quarterback of all time, and just saying, like, Russell is so off tonight. There were those two throws into the end zone, one of which should have been picked off by Quandre Diggs. It went through his hands, where he threw inside on the – I think it was like a go route, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then he threw inside on another vertical route on the outside that should have gone to the outside later. And I wouldn't say that Russell Wilson was so off in this game, but it almost felt like the situation, not to get inside the head of it, like everyone was amped up in this game, and he didn't seem to be seeing the field too well. Jamal Adams also had his annual or almost gamely, every game he has a ball go off his helmet at some point early in the game. Unfortunately, he went down with an injury. And it just felt like, yeah, Russell Wilson's been in the league a long time, but Russell Wilson and Nathaniel Hackett have not been in the league a long time together. And especially the two-minute operation, which you saw at the end, which Russell Wilson's usually good at, and then just getting the snap off and having everything set before the snap was a nightmare. They had 3 delay of games, and the fumble on the goal line – one of the fumbles on the goal line, I have to point out, because there was more than one inside the 10, was partly because Russell Wilson did not get the ball snapped until the very last second, and it was another frantic operation where the defensive lineman on that play, I think it was Al Woods, I wish I knew off the top of my head, you know, going from 1-0 and is just flying off the ball, and the offensive line really wasn't ready for it, and he ends up causing a fumble on that play. So their operation just was very weak one, which we've seen around the league, but is a concern.
Yeah, and there was such like a big thing made about Russell Wilson really taking ownership of this offense. So I do think like it's fair to criticize him for even the last snap where they let the clock run down. So I'm going to take every opportunity to put it on Russell Wilson.
Wow.
I'm trying to hype up my man Gino.
Okay, let's get to the good stuff here. I mean, people are listening to this thinking like, I can't believe you just spent like 8 minutes or 10 minutes talking about the end of the game and Russell Wilson before getting to Gino. I don't think I've ever had my mentions be as active in a single NFL game in my entire life. I don't know about you, Steven. What about you?
No. It
really?
It was every second I was getting a notification on my phone.
Like, what is
and
it?
And I was...
What does it say about us? So, like, in theory, it would be great. You know, I would love it if Mark and Dan were here on this podcast too with me. We're trying something different on Monday nights. We're going to have a guest every week, and they'll have their say on Tuesday too. I know that they'd be giving me grief right now, Steven. They'd be hating life. They were absolutely rooting for the Broncos because they knew I'd be so insufferable for the rest of the week because of this. But this is not the Fair and Balanced podcast. We're going to bury Russell Wilson, and we're going to praise Geno Smith. And he gave us so much to praise. Was it even better? And I know they didn't score in the second half, and the final score is 17-16. But in terms of Geno's performance, what was it even a little better than you dared dreamed, Steven Ruiz?
Oh, yeah. I was telling people I'm going to be unbearable when he goes 17 for 31 for like 200 yards and one touchdown. But he did much better than that.
23 and for like 28 for 195 and two.
Nice. No turnovers. No picks. I know he made that one throw, the cross field throw, but that was a dime. I didn't expect him to be that good. And I think he made some plays that were unsustainable. He's not going to be able to like move up in the pocket and throw those little floaters over the zone coverage that he did. Like it's felt like he did like four times in the first half. But this Geno Nation thing started with one idea.
Okay.
And the idea was that Geno can play.
Right.
That's all we were arguing. No, we weren't saying he was a top 20 quarterback. We weren't saying the Jets should build around him. All we were saying was the guy can play.
Although
give him
you do a quarterback rankings at the Ringer. People should check that out along with our great quarterback index by Mark. I think they're great companion pieces. You had Geno pretty high. You had him above Tua, I remember. How high was he going into the season?
22.
I mean, that
22.
Would definitely, if I was still doing QB index, I don't know if I would have had the stones to put him there. But the thought is, and I think Dan thinks this is a bit, and to the point that I've carried this torch forever, I guess it sort of is, but I always thought he showed it early in his New York career enough that he was like a professional quarterback.
Yes.
And that he literally never got the chance to, and because it was New York, he became a punchline, and people have this idea that like Geno went through this like horrible string of games where he struggled. No, he finished off that 2014 season well. That's the four game stretch they make fun of me on the show, and he's had like a handful of starts the rest of his career. Literally five more over the last 7 years. He never got the second chance after the IK and Impali punch, and that's what he's been working on all over these years. And I think tonight actually gave some hope that. He's improved. He's a 32-year-old quarterback now. He could be better, and I agree with you. The way he moved up in the pocket was really good, and when he's impressing Troy Aikman, Steven, with his command at the line of scrimmage and all the changes that he's making and the checks and how he's setting the offensive line, like, if he's impressing Troy, it's like Sam Darnold's not impressing Troy out there. Troy's burying Sam Darnold. He's not burying Geno.
No, he's not. And you can't like this. This is all over Geno's film, too. I'm telling you, man, I've been banging the drum all over preseason film. He was calling out protections. He was changing the plays. It was something that Drew Lock wasn't doing. It was very clear who was going to win this battle. I know like the media in Seattle was making a thing about it because you got to get attention on the QB battle. But it was clear all summer who was out in front and what Pete Carroll valued. And then we saw today that he was like the perfect quarterback for Pete Carroll. And I think the one thing that people get wrong about Geno is they don't realize like how tough he is in the pocket. Like that's his main thing is like he's a pocket passer. And I don't think people give him that credit. He's like an air raid quarterback. He was thrown for like 500 yards every game at West Virginia, but this dude can run a pro style offense. And honestly, he can run an offense, run the offense that the Seahawks want to run a lot better than Russell Wilson can do.
Ooh, speak on that. Why do you think that? Because when I was watching it tonight, I definitely thought this is what Pete Carroll wants to do. Now, I don't think he got the running game going nearly as much. I'm kind of shocked that Geno threw the ball 22 times or 28 times, and they only ran it 13 times if you don't count Geno's scrambles. They obviously didn't have that many plays in general. It was just one of those types of games. But they kind of went pass heavy for the most part early, or at least balanced. Like, it was almost him being like, as Troy said during the game, yeah, all right, we're going to let Geno cook a little bit, show you we can win that way, Russ.
I mean, it's going to sound crazy to say, and it's only sickos like us that think about the game like this and think about Geno Smith like this, but obviously, Russell Wilson is a far better quarterback than Geno Smith, and it's not even close. But the thing about Russell Wilson is he needs this particular style of offense. And we don't like to talk about his height being a factor, but it matters. Like we've covered, he doesn't see the field over the middle. It's tough for him because he's like 5'10". Offensive linemen are huge. It's tough to see over the middle of the field. And another thing he doesn't like to do is play from under center. And when you run this like outside zone, the Shanahan McVay stuff, you have to run that from under center because that's like just the timing of the runs. The outside zone play is hard to run from the gun. So, like I mentioned earlier, there's this lack of synergy between what Russ wants to do in the pass game, what Nathaniel Hackett wants to do in the run game, what Shane Waldron wanted to do in the run game last year. And if you listen to like Seattle players, they were talking about like Rashad Penny during the offseason was like, oh yeah, I really like running from under center and we're doing it a lot more now. He didn't say because Russell Wilson is gone, but that's the quiet part, is that it's because Russell Wilson is gone. So I think while they're losing a lot of talent at the quarterback position, the gap is kind of smaller because of they can run the scheme they actually want to run.
So you're making so many amazing points, and every once in a while I'm just like laughing. And it's not because you said anything funny. It's because I'm just like basking in this moment that this is the most indulgent podcast I will ever do at NFL Media. We've been doing – this is our 10th season – and it's all been leading to this. This could be like kind of the top, and it's almost a sign that I've gone over the Rubicon. Like, we're going to spend 20 minutes on Geno tonight because this was the Geno Super Bowl. I really don't care what happens the rest of the season. Of course I care. I want it to go well. I've said all along, I think this is a 9-8 type of Seahawks season that Pete Carroll like enjoys more than virtually any season he's ever coached. And I can still see that all happening. But to win tonight and to have the MVP chance of Geno at one point, which was just hilarious, and to hear everything you're saying, which to me makes a lot of sense, and I think it's absolutely true. I think Pete Carroll, at a certain point, just wanted someone that would do what he said. And like, maybe that's not how the boss should feel. I was kind of on the hook saying, like, did – ownership should absolutely choose Russell Wilson over Pete Carroll, but it became a choice at some point. They clearly didn't get along ultimately, or didn't agree on how this organization should be run. And I did find it interesting. James Palmer, our NFL Network reporter at the scene, said, you know, Geno and Russell, great conversation. They've always gotten along really well. Russell's dapping up everyone before the game. He's talking to everyone. He's on the field forever. Pete Carroll's out there, and Russell says hi to just about everyone. And those two men are like 20 feet apart for much of the pregame, and they didn't say a word. They didn't say a word. That's the real heat. Everyone tried to make the Belichick-Brady heat. This is the real heat, and it ends this way, I think, with Pete Carroll winning the type of ugly, weird game that they shouldn't win, and yet it is the type of game that they have won a lot of times with Russell Wilson. Geno, though, did come through on third and longs. I thought that was like a really key part of the game. He went 6 of 10 on third downs overall, and they were averaging, I think, 8 yards on those third downs. And to go 6 of 10 when you're averaging, you know, 8 yards to go is really good. And he was making good decisions. And you said it, he was feeling himself when he threw that crossbody pass. That's when I knew it was just like Geno was having an out-of-body experience.
And then they called the quarterback sweep on third and short.
Oh, my God.
Geno design run game. Geno Lamar Jackson, he could do it all. He could do it all. He
was running a little too much. He ran actually the play before that as well on a scramble, and he didn't get down and took a big hit. And I was just like, Geno's a little faster than you think, but he's not a good runner. You know, he's right. Like Daniel Jones is really fast and not a good runner. Geno's not fast and not particularly a good runner. He's
it's
just like
Jameis.
Right, but he's still like Jameis. He's still like a little faster than you think. He picked up some key yards with his legs, but he was getting a little too full of himself. Maybe he was just letting the emotion overtake him. I mean, he was doing the fist pumps on the sideline. He was dancing early in the game, and then after the game, Geno with just the most beautiful quote to the sideline reporter on Monday Night Football.
They wrote me off. I ain't right back though. That's the problem. I ain't right back. Let's go.
I don't even know what that means, but I like
it. Man, we didn't write you off, Geno. Don't you forget that.
No. Does he follow you on Twitter, Steven? Not to get like too weird about this, but.
No, but he's liked a couple of my tweets.
Okay.
Very proud moment for me.
Yeah, same. And at some point, he did follow me in the last year or two when I don't know. So I had said something or written something incredibly, you know, generous to him. And at that moment, he followed me. It was a big moment. He hears what's going out here. I wish they could just someone could just send him this podcast and he could listen to it on his drive into work this week.
I had a banger that he ended up retweeting and then he deleted the retweet. But I like it was right after Jimmy G had signed his deal in San Francisco that made him like the highest paid player ever. And I compared like Jimmy G's last seven starts or his only seven starts for the 49ers to Geno's last five. And Geno was better. He was way better statistically.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I actually think the defense for the Seahawks was more concerning than I expected in this game, which sounds strange. But they lost Jamal Adams. And this is part of the reason why the Broncos should have won this game. The Broncos were getting pretty good push in the running game. They end up with 19 carries for over 5 yards per carry. I mean, when you're running for 6, 7, 8 yards in the first, second, third quarter, like you expect, you know, that's a huge advantage for you. It should set up the passing game. And then the Seahawks lose Jamal Adams during the game. Who else did they lose there? Tariq Woolen, I believe, went out during the game, who was starting at quarterback. They benched their other rookie cornerback, Kobe Bryant. I mean, the Seahawks are playing two mid to late round rookies and then replacing them with like journeymen like Sidney Jones. Cody Barton got hurt at the very end. But like this is a defense that wasn't getting nearly as much push as I guess I expected up front. And that's part of the reason why I'm being a little hard on Russell Wilson is most of those yards that he got were after he had a lot of time in the pocket. Yeah. He was protected better, and I think that's a good sign for the Broncos ultimately than he was for most of his Seahawks career.
Yeah, that stood out. It's the Seahawks pass protection stood out, but I agree with you with this defense. The young secondary is really concerning because they brought in a lot of new assistant coaches. They're trying to change the philosophy. Pete Carroll's known for his cover three defense. They brought in Sean Desai. They brought in Carl Scott. These are guys that run these more modern defensive coverages. And part of it is that they like to, you need communication because they're matching up, they're passing off routes. And when you have a young secondary, that's going to be hard. And you saw it today, there was a lot of air in the coverage. There was a lot of open receivers over the middle of the field. And then you add in the running game. If you can't stop the Nathaniel Hackett version of this offense, and you're going up against the Kyle Shanahan version with Trey Lance and McVay.
All right, let's not bring it down. Let's just enjoy this moment, you know?
That's true. That's true.
This this was special. I mean, like I said, we've been talking about Geno Smith for a long time on this show, and I was so confident, Steven, on this show that this reference will have no meaning to you whatsoever. But leading into this weekend, I actually broke out something I only do in a rare case. Let's play it here, Graver. That's right. The Rainmaker came through. I was just taking Seattle plus 6.5, but I did predict an 18-17 Seahawks victory. So you got them straight up. You got them covering and then some. Like, it all happened. It all happened on Monday night.
Oh. Never a doubt. Never a doubt. We had confidence in our guy, and he came through.
I feel like I had one more like important thing I wanted to get to, and I'm just blanking on it right now.
How about the Seahawks defense holding the Broncos at the 1 yard line on two different possessions, and then another goal line stand to force a field goal? You talk about the Seahawks defense not playing too well, but those were huge stops.
That's absolutely fair. I mean, the Seahawks defense over the year has always been bend, don't break. They've always been great at situational football. They've always been making big plays in the key moment. Like, you do wonder when you look through this defense, like, which guys are going to be able to step up. Do they have enough playmakers? Jordan Brooks, maybe. Not that he had a great game. Nuoso had a couple moments in this game when he came in on some stunts. You're absolutely right, Graver. They made some big plays in the big moments.
Yeah, I think they're, like, a year away from being good. Like, Woolen is, I think he's very talented. He still has some rough parts of his game. But, like, in a year or two, I think they're going to be good, especially when they get this new philosophy really installed and the young guys grow up. And I will say this, going up against Russell Wilson, it just makes for a weird game. So maybe I'm too quick to write off the Seattle defense.
Right, this was a week one game. Like, this, it was crazy how loud the boos were. Were you a little surprised about the aggressiveness of this Seahawks crowd, like, hating on Russell Wilson?
No, because I think things got a little strange over the offseason. Like, back in March or whenever the trade happened, I would not have expected those boos. But, like, over the last couple of months, there's been all these, like, stories and exposés that have come out. So I think it makes a little more sense. I think there's, like, a little bit of bitterness from Seattle fans now.
Mm. All right. So every Monday night on this recap, thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you to the viewers who stayed up with me on Channel 5 in the UK, which is a new gig. I got to enjoy this game live on that coverage. And thank you to everyone listening in. The plan for these Monday night shows, Stephen, is we're going to go through the Monday night game. And I'm not going to spend this much time on the Monday night game every week. But it was just too much not to. And then we would fire through a couple little thoughts or some takeaways from our Monday film watching. Now, we went so long here on Geno. I'm going to do, like, a speed round with you because you are truly one of the best football minds out there. Like, we're having fun here with Geno Smith, but people should check out all of Stephen Ruiz's coverage over at The Ringer and everything he's doing on The Ringer podcast and everything. I'm just wondering, while you were breaking down some tape on Monday, Sunday night, you seem like a Sunday night type of guy even. You're on the East Coast. You're staying up late with us, aren't you?
Yeah, I didn't go to sleep last night. First Monday of the season, I had to write for Monday morning.
You're up with us now?
I'm going.
I am loving
Geno adrenaline.
Oh, my God. I love the energy, and I apologize for making you work extra. Just give me two quick things that stuck out from you on your film watching today.
Bengals offense was the most interesting thing to me. And it's okay. People are going to talk about the 7 sacks, but that's not what I'm interested in. The thing that really surprised me and stood out is the lack of perimeter deep throws that Joe Burrow made. Like, the Steelers were able to take that away, and I think the Bengals are going to see a different type of coverage this year. They saw a lot of, like, cover one, a lot of, like, one-on-one matchups on the outside, a lot of man coverage. Teams have learned their lesson over the offseason, and Joe Burrow talked about it during the offseason. He said, like, we're gonna have to sustain drives more. You can't rely on explosive plays, and the Steelers really forced Joe Burrow to take those mid-range buckets, and he was unable to make them, and, like, he threw into coverage a lot, and the interceptions happened. But I think Joe Burrow is going to be better going forward. I think the offensive line was actually better than the stats make it look, but that's going to be a subplot to watch over the first month of the season. We could have a little, like, Chiefs Bills situation from last year where they were having a lot of trouble getting those downfield throws. I think the Bengals are this year's version of that.
That's a tasty nugget, and that makes sense. I think that Mike Tomlin is, like, a bad coach for a division opponent to face in week one. I was thinking about that, too, as the Patriots were playing the Dolphins. I was just thinking how Brian Flores is the worst coach for them to play. Not Brian Flores, yes. Rather Josh Boyer is now the defensive coordinator there. And now Brian Flores is going to be helping the defense they play next week in Pittsburgh. But I was thinking Josh Boyer and the Dolphins were the worst defense for them to play because they knew exactly what to do in terms of heating up Mac Jones with all these blitzes in week one. Not that other places couldn't have figured that out, but when you see it week one and you see how it works so well, it's like, oh, okay, everyone's going to copy that. Everyone's going to see what they did and try to replicate that. And I think in the same way, Mike Tomlin and Brian Flores would be among the two defensive minds in Pittsburgh that I would not want to face in week one, because right off the bat, I think you're going to see some dangerous stuff. One thing I saw watching on tape today, and we'll leave it with this because let's face it, this is all just like an afterthought to Geno, was how different the Saints looked entirely. Like, all of their strengths looked like weaknesses suddenly, and all their weaknesses now look like strengths. Like, they used to be able to really have faith in this offensive line, and I don't know. Like, they got some serious problems there with James Hurst at left tackle and just the lack of synchronicity. And their run defense has been so good year after year, and they really got run over, and their defensive tackle situation looks bad. Then again, they're great at wide receiver right now, and if they get in a situation where they trail and if they can sort of figure out the balance of letting Jameis be Jameis and be in shotgun a little more and throw the ball down the field, like, suddenly that could be a very dangerous part of their team. So they just look like – maybe it's just week one, but they just look like such a different team than they've been the last couple of years.
I'm going to give them a bit of a pass because of that week one weirdness thing. Like, the Falcons, I think, are one of the most unique schematic teams in the league this year. Mm-hmm. They were basically running like a college offense with Mariota, and it was a lot of option runs, and that's what the Saints were having trouble with, and they're not going to see that going forward. So I'll wait on the run defense. I still think they have good pieces on the defensive line. And then on the other side of the ball, going up against Dean Pease, who's like the most creative pressure designer in the league, he was giving them fits. So I'll
that's
wait
fair
to be worried about the
Falcons are like playing App State early in the college football season, or it's some like underfunded,
like a triple option team. They're
right,
a service academy.
It's like an underfunded, under-talented team with like a crazy and innovative coaching staff, except they're an NFL team, so that's not really what you want. But I do think their coaching staff is kind of ahead of where their personnel talent is. Nothing's getting ahead of tonight, though. This is it. Steven, we enjoyed. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed having you on. Like, they can't take this away from us. Like, they said it was a bit. They never believed it. Let's hear it from Gino again, Graver. I mean, what is it? They said it.
They wrote me off. I ain't right back, though. That's the problem. I ain't right back. Let's go.
They wrote us off. We ain't writing back, Steven Ruiz. We ain't writing back.
That's a lie. I'm going to write back all night long. I'm going to be replying to tweets all night long. I'm not going to sleep.
Thanks, Steven. Again, check him out at the podcast, at The Ringer, and all of his coverage there. For Steven Ruiz, I'm Greg Rosenthal. We will be back on Tuesday with Colleen Wolf. It's coming up soon. Till then, heed the call.